Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. If anyone should require assistance, please press star then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. At this time, I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Well, thank you very much, Stephanie. I, too, would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Connect workshop, Living with Myelofibrosis. And today's program is Overview of Myelofibrosis, Current Treatment Options, and Quality of Life Concerns. Now, this is part one of a two-part series, and we're delighted to have so many of you on the call today. Today's program is a collaborative effort between Cancer Care and many other cancer organizations, including MPN Education Foundation and MPN Research Foundation, and it really is their collaboration, as well as all the other groups that have collaborated today that have made this program possible. And we have on the program today over 494 participants, and you come from all over the United States, and we have international participants from Canada, Denmark, Taiwan, Tunisia, and the United Kingdom. So really from all over the world, and it's a credit to you that you've chosen to spend the next hour with us. Today's activity was made possible by the Insight Corporation, CPI Biopharma Corporation, and Baxter International, Inc., and I really want to thank them for their support of this program and for their corporate collaboration in making this program and this entire series possible. Now, you have received some information from Cancer Care, and I want to call out to you information about the evaluation form that you've received. I want to ask you all to take a moment at the end of today's program and complete that evaluation form. We very much rely on your feedback to let us know if the program is meeting your needs and also if there are other topics you would like us to offer going forward related to myelofibrosis. So it's really helpful to us to hear from you. Indeed, today's program and this entire series is based on the feedback that we have received from you on previous programs. Now, we have wonderful speakers on our program today, and I want to begin by introducing our first speaker. And our first speaker is Dr. Serdan Verstovzek, and Dr. Verstovzek is Professor of Medicine, Director, Haynes A. Pins, Clinical Research Center for Myeloproliferative Neoplasms, Department of Leukemia, the University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center. And Dr. Verstovzek is going to address an overview of myelofibrosis, review of current therapies, and communicating with your healthcare team. It's my pleasure and honor to present to you Dr. Verstovzek.
Thank you, Carolyn, and thank you, colleagues, for allowing me to participate in this important event today. Certainly, myelofibrosis is an important topic to discuss when we talk about myeloproliferative neoplasms. You see, myeloproliferative neoplasms, the name describes exactly what is the problem. Myeloid stands for the bone marrow cells, proliferative meaning the cells grow without control, and neoplasms indicating that that's not normal growth. And there are different types of myeloproliferative neoplasms. Usually, the names are derived from what is the problem in a blood cell count, cells growing without control. And if the problem is with the platelets, then this is called essential thrombocythemia. If all the cells grow, and usually that's a problem with red blood cells in particular, then the disease is called polycythemia, which means all the cells grow in Latin. If we have some other types of cells grow, like eosinophils or neutrophils, then we call this chronic eosinophilic or neutrophilic leukemia. Here, with myelofibrosis, the name is derived from the description of the bone marrow. This disease also has this proliferative nature. The cells do grow without control, but because of the uncontrolled growth of the cells for some reason, and we don't really know why, the bone marrow environment, the cells that support the growth of cells in the bone marrows, react by producing some proteins that lead to scarring tissue that develops over time and gets worse. So patients with myelofibrosis are a little bit different than any other types of patients with myeloproliferative neoplasms. Most of the time, they present with too few cells. Patients may present with the high vitals or high platelets. They may have low vitals or platelets, but almost everybody has anemia. And what happens with this disease, unlike any other, is that the body of the patient reacts to the malfunctioning bone marrow by enlarging organs that are important for blood production. You may know from pictures of the patient with myelofibrosis that about 80 to 90% of the patients develop a very big spleen, and about 40% of the patients develop a very big liver. spleen can be 20 times normal size. And maybe in some cases that spleen also contributes to production of some blood cells. This is not clear yet, but it does affect the body of the patient a lot. Patients start to lose weight. The body also suffers from inability to walk. There is a lot of inflammation going on with the disease, bone aches pains, night sweating, itching, a lot of systemic symptoms, symptoms related to the big organs. It's not very pleasant picture. It is getting worse over time, and the disease has a potential to shorten life expectancy, unfortunately, of the affected individual. For the purpose of assessing the patients, we do need to have a bone marrow biopsy done. We have to find the fibrosis there. That is one test that needs to be done, bone marrow biopsy. Fibrosis is present. There are exceptions to this rule, and this has to be taken along with the findings of abnormal blood cell count, meaning anemia, abnormal types of white cells in the blood, abnormal chemistry test for one of the proteins that is released from dead cells called lactate dehydrogenase, or LDH, and big spleen. I'm listing all of this together to get a good sense to listeners that it is not one test or just a bone marrow biopsy that leads to a diagnosis of myelofibrosis. It's a combination of the bone marrow biopsy, physical exam looking for big spleen, looking at the chemistry for elevation in LDH, and looking at the blood cell count, anemia, and abnormal types of white cells, the bone marrow cells, can be seen in the blood. This is all taken together for diagnosis to happen. Now we also look at some genetic abnormalities that can be present in this disease that helps make a diagnosis, like a JAK2 mutation or calreticulin mutation and some others. When we come to the therapy, however, there are two important aspects here. First, we look at the prognosis of the patient based on several factors. The academic physicians in this area of MPN developed what we call international prognostic scoring systems that can be used at the time of diagnosis or during the therapy evolution and give us some sense, importantly from past experience, which may not be true right this minute, but from the past experience, we can assess in some semi-intelligent way what the future will bring to a patient. And this is important because we tend to, those young patients with advanced features, refer to a bone marrow transplant as the only curative potential that we have, or any among the all the medical therapies that we have, the bone marrow transplant is the only one that can eliminate disease and cure the patient. So with prognostication based on some factors, we decide for younger patients that are in advanced phase to many times refer them for the bone marrow transplant. Otherwise, when we look at the patients, we look at the areas of what matters for the patient's quality of life, how is disease behaving, and usually we are talking about three areas of concern. These are anemia, very big organs that may be symptomatic, so splenomegaly or enlargement of the liver, and very poor quality of life with decrease in ability to walk, weight loss, and systemic symptoms. So quality of life, anemia, and the spleen. For anemia, traditionally we would try to help patients improve the blood cell count and prevent transfusions. Either this is with steroids like a prednisone or testosterone-like medication, so some hormonal preparation. Perhaps with in early stage of the disease, also with interferon preparations, although limited experience exists there, or with some injections of the growth factors for red blood cells called erythropoietin, or thalidomide or lenalidomide. These are other medications that are approved for some other diseases that sometimes we use with some success for anemia in myelofibrosis. Nothing really works to a great extent for too long, unfortunately, for anemia. That's one of the unmet needs, really, in myelofibrosis. Then we talk about the spleen and symptoms. And here, more than 3 years ago, we had a new development, which was a development of a ruxolitinib, a first JAK inhibitor, which helps with the spleen, liver, and the symptoms, improves patient's condition, decreases the organs in many to different extents, and the people fare better with these two major problems. It does not improve anemia. That would be anecdotal. It may actually worsen blood cell count in some patients, and those adjustments are mandatory in majority of the patients during the first 3 to 6 months to find the best dose for long-term outcome. With the good control of symptoms and signs, ruxolitinib was actually shown to prolong a life of some patients with advanced features for several years. But no therapy apart from the transplant really eliminates disease. We are controlling the signs and symptoms and make people enjoy life fully for much longer, but we are not eliminating disease. Perhaps a combination of a JAK inhibitors followed by transplant, where we improve the condition of patient before transplant, is the next best step for many patients. We assess this situation with the patients in a clinic, and this is the important part for one to gather from this discussion. It's not just the physicians that are assessing the condition. It is important team effort in assessing how is the quality of life is of the patients, what is the problem. It's not just about the CBC, the blood cell count and measuring the spleen. It's about quality of life and a communication between the patients and healthcare team for the success to happen. Communication is the mandatory part, and a team effort will be fruitful the most for the patients with myelofibrosis. And with that, I would transition to a discussion with Dr. Robles for some other important aspects of myelofibrosis. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Vistovec. Really an excellent presentation and overview, and I look forward to questions for you during the Q&A. Thank you. And our next speaker is Dr. Gail Robles. Dr. Robles is Associate Professor of Medicine, Director of the Clinical and Translational Leukemia Programs, Weill Medical College of Cornell University, New York Presbyterian Hospital. And Dr. Robles is going to address the role of clinical trials, how research contributes to treatment options, and reducing complications of myelofibrosis. It's my pleasure now to turn the program over to Dr. Robles.
Hi, everyone. This is Dr. Gail Robles. I am the director of the leukemia program at Weill Cornell Medical Center and the New York Presbyterian Hospital, and I'm very happy to be on the call today. Thank you so much for the invitation. I treat many patients with myelofibrosis, and I've been given a few tasks today to go over in these remarks, and the first topic is the role of clinical trials. As you have been hearing, we actually have some new options for the treatment of myelofibrosis, and certainly ruxolitinib, which is marketed as Jakafi and an agent which has been discussed and will continue to be discussed, is something that we are talking about because of relatively recently completed clinical trials involving many hundreds of patients. And I'll tell you that a lot of the discussion of the benefits of this agent, as well as all of the agents that we deal with both in oncology and in the rest of medicine, are really thanks to the incredible efforts of patients and their families who participate in clinical trials. And I think it's worth starting out by mentioning that most patients do not actually have a very accurate concept of what a clinical trial involves. I think that many patients are frightened at the prospect of being maybe a guinea pig or maybe trying something that's new that hasn't been proven. I certainly understand why that can be a frightening concept, but a lot of the times when we're talking about a therapeutic clinical trial or a clinical trial that's involving a new drug, many times patients who are being offered such a trial are being offered because the standardly available therapies are simply not effective enough. And I think one very important point to keep in mind is that for any disease, just because a therapy is standard or standardly available doesn't mean it's effective. So one of the main considerations that patients will have in thinking about participating in a clinical trial is, well, what are my options? What would standard therapy offer me in my current situation? And what might an investigational drug offer me? It is definitely stressful to think about taking something new, but it actually takes the edge off a lot if you are aware of the reason why you're being offered something new and hopefully better than what would otherwise be available to you. Many people are concerned about, for example, a placebo-controlled clinical trial or a clinical trial in which they may not have the opportunity to receive the investigational drug, but rather may receive something called a placebo, which might be a sugar pill. This is also something, though, that when carefully explained to patients, is a much less frightening or objectionable concept than what people originally think, because sometimes we actually really truly don't know whether a novel drug is actually better than doing nothing, than just supportive care. And if you look at the clinical trials that resulted in the approval of ruxolitinib, they actually were randomized trials in which patients were either going to get the investigational drug or going to get what their doctor would normally offer them under the circumstances, which would have been best supportive care. And I have to tell you that the patients on those trials who didn't receive the investigational drug still, in many situations, benefited from the participation, because ultimately, when it became clear that the drug worked, they were able to have an available agent for their condition. So I do think that whether or not it's a therapy trial or a placebo-controlled trial, I think a careful conversation with your doctor about why it might be the right thing for you is super important, especially in diseases like myelofibrosis, where the previously existing standards were so ineffective. Now, here, we've had a direct contribution of recent clinical trials to treatment options. And what has been seen specifically in the last several years after the major myelofibrosis trials were initiated is that the novel agent, in this case ruxolitinib, not only made symptoms better for patients, things like itching or fatigue or large spleen size, weight loss, lots of different signs and symptoms that patients with myelofibrosis had. But it also seems, as we follow the data over a period of years, that possibly the drug may be doing better than just modifying symptoms. It may actually be helping the bone marrow to function better over time and possibly contribute to patients living longer on therapy than they would have had they not been taking the drug. All of this information is coming from serially following patients participating in the clinical trials, because honestly, once drugs are approved, it becomes much more difficult to know what's happening for individual patients as they see their individual doctors. And the truth of the matter is that when a patient goes into the doctor's office, you want to know, well, how long is this going to work for me? How long will my symptoms be improved? How much time might I have increased in my survival? All of these important questions can only be answered by serially following patients in an organized way and collecting the data about what happens to them as they continue on their new therapy. Now, one other important thing to keep in mind that we've certainly learned in studying myelofibrosis is that it's not only about learning what a new drug might do in a clinical trial. There are clinical trials that also are focusing on using other older drugs or approved drugs and seeing how they might work in myelofibrosis. And there are also survey-based trials in which patients are asked for information about how they're feeling and what their symptoms are and how they interact with their physicians. And the many hundreds of patients who've participated in these different types of trials and surveys have really made an enormous contribution to the world of myelofibrosis by helping us all understand what they're going through, what the symptoms are, how they impact quality of life, what are the areas that healthcare providers need to know that a therapy should target for improvement. Because clearly, making the underlying disease better, making survival better, these are very important goals of therapy. But I think most patients with advanced myelofibrosis will certainly certainly agree that the quality of life considerations are also extremely important, and the clinical trials which have gathered data on improvement in symptoms and improvement in quality of life have offered enormous insight into what can be expected from the novel therapy and what we can tell patients about what their response to therapy is likely to include. So I have to say, as you can certainly hear from my remarks, that I am a major, major believer in clinical trials in general, but in particular for the areas in which I specialize, the bone marrow disorders, where they're not common diseases and where we really have to pool patients together and monitor carefully what happens to them in order to offer better therapies. Nowhere is this more obvious than if you look at the recent myelofibrosis story, in which the participation of these hundreds of patients onto clinical trials, both in the United States and in Europe, resulted in the ability to offer a new therapy with benefits for many patients. I appreciate the time to go over these comments, and I'll turn the program back now to Carolyn Messner.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Robos. Very informative, and also just that highlighting of management of the issue of the clinical trials as well as the reducing complications. Thank you so much. And our next presenter is Dr. Christina Gowen. Dr. Gowen is a hematology and medical oncology fellow at Mayo Clinic in Arizona. And Dr. Gowen is going to address symptom and pain management, the importance of follow-up care, and quality of life concerns. It's my pleasure to turn the program over to Dr. Gowen.
Oh, thank you very much, Dr. Messner, for that kind introduction. And really, thank you for the opportunity to participate today in today's very important conference call. So the symptom complex for those afflicted with myelofibrosis really may vary vastly, and this can range from mild to very severe symptoms. Of all the myeloproliferative diagnoses, myelofibrosis really tends to be the most symptomatic of the group. Educating yourself as a patient or as a caregiver on the potential associated symptoms, their optimal management, can really aid in communication with treating providers and thus enhance the quality of care. So why do symptoms occur? And I think it's very important to revisit the biology of myelofibrosis to understand why symptoms may occur. Remember, myelofibrosis disrupts the normal production of the body's blood cells within the bone marrow. This disruption can lead to scarring within the bone marrow, and ultimately can lead to the body producing blood cells in other areas of the body, such as the spleen and the liver. Because of this blood production within the spleen and the liver, the organs themselves may enlarge. Both of these organs, both the spleen and the liver, are housed within the abdominal cavity, and when enlarged, can cause symptoms of abdominal pain, feeling full quickly, and feelings of abdominal swelling. Additionally, when the spleen enlarges and stretches, chemicals called cytokines are released, and these can actually cause fever, night sweats, fatigue, and significant amount of weight loss. The most common presenting complaint is severe fatigue, and this occurs in up to 70% of those afflicted with myelofibrosis. This can be related to the disease itself, but may also be exacerbated by the concurrent anemia that's hallmark of myelofibrosis. Other symptoms may occur, and these include itching, bone pain, and psychosocial disturbance, such as depression and anxiety. Myelofibrosis may additionally be associated with the risk of thrombosis or blood clots. Symptoms of leg redness, swelling, or pain, chest pain, shortness of breath, numbness or tingling in the arms or legs, or difficulty walking or speaking may all indicate a blood clot in different areas of the body. It may occur in the leg, the lung, the heart, or the brain. If any of these symptoms should occur, they should be evaluated emergently by a healthcare provider. So now you know a little bit about why symptoms occur, but I'm sure you're all very interested in how can you best manage the symptoms when they do occur. The most important component of symptom management is really communication with your primary provider. It's important to know that it's your symptoms that drive treatment recommendations and often direct therapy. A symptom assessment form may be given at your office visit by your hematologist, and this is called an MPN-SAF, or myeloproliferative neoplasm, symptom assessment form. This really helps providers gauge the severity and the constellation of your particular symptoms and helps guide their recommendations. Note that not all providers may administer this, and perhaps it would be important to keep a symptom diary at home so you may accurately relay your symptom complex to your provider. And this is particularly important if that MPN symptom assessment form is not routinely utilized at your hematologist practice. So what are some potential recommendations for the treatment of myelofibrosis symptoms? In general, it's extremely important to be sure you're doing all you can from a lifestyle perspective. Some important factors to consider include ensuring that you're getting adequate rest each night, having a good, balanced diet, are getting exercise most days of the week, and practicing stress reduction techniques. As previously discussed, symptoms associated with myelofibrosis can be treated with FDA-approved pharmacologic medications, such as JAK inhibitors like ruxolitinib. In addition to this pharmacologic therapy, other therapeutic adjuncts can be very helpful in particular scenarios. Weight loss, if occurs, can be addressed with a nutritionist. If this is a problem for you, I encourage you to ask for a referral. Oftentimes, supplements are very helpful in this scenario. Bone pain can occur in myelofibrosis patients, and oftentimes pain medications, such as opiates, can be very helpful. Itching can be a problem. Consider utilizing antihistamines such as hydroxyzine. Anxiety and depression. Medications and mental health professionals can assist in the treatment of these disorders. Do not hesitate to mention symptoms and ask for a referral. Fatigue. As mentioned previously, fatigue can be profound. Ensure you're doing all you can from a lifestyle perspective and addressing any concurrent psychosocial disturbances. If these components are fully addressed and the fatigue is still persisting, sometimes stimulant medications are useful to help alleviate the fatigue, medications such as methylphenidate. I encourage you to discuss the role of all of these adjunctive therapies with your treating provider and query whether you could benefit from their addition. Depending on the severity of symptoms, quality of life can be drastically affected in patients afflicted with myelofibrosis. All aspects of life can be affected, including home life, with decreasing ability to keep up with the demands of the household, difficulty keeping obligations, and missed days of work. Friends, family, caregivers, and employers should be educated on the effect of quality of life in myelofibrosis and be preemptive about backup plans. I can't emphasize enough how important it is to obtain routine follow-up. Detecting subtle changes in symptom complex may change treatment recommendations and should be relayed diligently. Remember that the healthcare team is broad and should be utilized in its entirety, including nurses, pharmacists, social workers, nutritionists, physical therapists, amongst others. Be sure you are utilizing all of your available resources. And finally, remember, the symptoms associated with myelofibrosis may vary greatly from subtle disease to severe symptoms. Quality of life can be affected dramatically, and communication, again, is key to addressing these symptoms optimally, with not only the healthcare team, but also with your caregivers, your friends, your family, and your employers. Remember, many medications are available to treat symptoms. And finally, I can't emphasize this enough, lifestyle factors such as diet, exercise, and stress reduction are important adjuncts to any successful myelofibrosis symptom treatment program. Thank you so much for joining me today, and I'm going to turn the call back over to Dr. Messner. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Dr. Gowan. That was really extraordinary and very informative for everybody on the call. And I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A, so thank you. And our next presenter is Ms. Anna Eckhart. Ms. Eckhart is an oncology social worker. She's our online support group program coordinator at Cancer Care. And Ms. Eckhart is going to address with you the free psychosocial services that you can receive from Cancer Care, as well as our support groups. And my pleasure now to turn this program over to Ms. Eckhart.
Thank you, Carolyn. It's really wonderful to be part of this important conversation about helping patients and loved ones cope with and attempt to understand myelofibrosis. I'd like to begin by speaking broadly and then more specifically about our services. There are many ways Cancer Care can be part of your network, and there are many ways we can help. Adjusting to and dealing with the diagnosis is an important part of the healing process. As social workers, we would argue that it is an essential part. Here at Cancer Care, we are a national nonprofit organization that provides free professional support services to anyone affected by cancer. All our services are provided by licensed master's level oncology social workers and are completely free of charge. Oncology social workers, like myself, are trained in how a diagnosis of cancer affects a person and his or her family and friends. We are also trained to help people with cancer and their families tackle the problems that accompany the disease, such as the financial demands, the physical changes, social adjustment, and psychological impact, and overall care. Additionally, we provide education about resources and how to navigate the healthcare system, help you find practical help, and discuss some limited financial assistance, such as how to apply for chemo copay assistance. I want to also talk about the importance of creating a support network when you're diagnosed with cancer or caring for someone. Asking for help by joining a support group or by contacting a social worker for counseling is a sign of strength. You do not have to walk this path alone. Joining a support group is a way to connect with others who are going through a similar situation or have similar problems. You can share experiences and learn from each other. Group members provide a listening ear and share tips and resources they've utilized along the way. And Cancer Care support groups are moderated by professional oncology social workers. We offer face-to-face support groups as well as telephone and online groups. Currently, for those diagnosed with myelofibrosis, we offer an online blood cancer support group, and this 15-week online support group is for people diagnosed with a blood or bone cancer who are currently receiving treatment. The online program group allows people from all over the world to write and share about their cancer experiences. Visiting our website at www.cancercare.org is the first step in the registration and screening for this and all our online groups. Caregivers can access support through our telephone and online caregiver support groups as well. These groups provide a safe, supportive environment for sharing your feelings and discussing the challenges and rewards of being a caregiver. Also, we have a unique young adult program and offer both a patient and caregiver online support group for people between the ages of 20 and 39 years old who are currently dealing with a cancer diagnosis in their lives. And if you choose to pursue individual counseling, this type of support provides a space that is just yours to voice any concerns. all these connections help lessen the isolation that many people with cancer experience. And feeling well emotionally can help you better deal with a diagnosis and treatment. If you are interested in any of cancer care services, please call our Hope Line at 1-800-813-4673. Or if it's that online support group that interests you, then again, visit our website at www.cancercare.org. Please remember that you are not alone. Cancer Care Services are there to help you. Thank you for your attention and the opportunity to talk with you today.
Oh, thank you so much, Ms. Eckhart, for that really excellent and compassionate presentation about our services. And I know there'll be questions for you also during the Q&A, so thank you. And now we have time for questions. I'm going to ask Stephanie to bring all of our speakers on board and also to explain to all of you how to queue up and ask questions, and we're going to try to take as many of your questions as possible. If we do not get to your question, please call us at the end of the call at 1-800-813-HOPE, and I'll repeat that number again toward the end of the call, but let's see if we can take most of your questions right now. Stephanie?
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. If you would like to ask a question, please press star then one on your touchtone telephone. If your question has been answered and you wish to remove yourself from the queue, you may press the pound key. Those of you on the web may submit questions by clicking Ask a Question. Again, please press star then one to ask a question.
And we have a question from one of our online participants, and it really has to do with the flu season being upon us. And the question is, should I take any additional measures while I undergo treatment? Dr. Gowen, can you address that question about getting a flu shot or in terms of any precautions for people living with myelofibrosis?
Absolutely.
Being treated as well? Yes.
So with anybody with chronic ongoing malignancies, I do recommend the administration of the flu vaccine as well as the pneumonia vaccine. Now, that's with the caveat knowing that there are different preparations of the flu vaccine out there, and there's live preparations and then killed preparations. The killed preparations are the actual injections, and the live are the intranasal administration. And so I recommend for patients to get the killed vaccine or the injection. Now, patients who have very low immune systems or are neutropenic certainly have to take more precautions than the typical patient population. That means if you're traveling for the holidays, perhaps, then routine hand washing and perhaps even wearing a mask through the airport or shopping through the mall would be judicious. For the general population of myeloproliferative neoplasms or myelofibrosis, most patients will not be neutropenic or have a very, very low white blood cell. And so just routine hand washing, being sure that you're not exposing yourself to infections, maybe from the little ones around in the holidays, would be judicious.
Excellent. Thank you. And Dr. Vistovsek, did you want to add anything to that? Or?
I think I fully agree. This is a really good summary.
Excellent. Okay. So that... that's a good question, and thank you for that. Thank you, Dr. Gowen, for that excellent answer. So there are other questions about vaccinations as well in terms of shingles vaccine as well. Again, Dr. Gowen, could you address that?
Okay, shingles vaccine is a live virus. And so typically I don't recommend the shingles vaccine, particularly for the immune-compromised patients, those who, again, are neutropenic. Over 50, it is recommended. And if they're not neutropenic, if patients are not neutropenic, then it likely is safe.
Okay, excellent. And are there any other type of immunizations that people should be aware of?
Well, I think the routine ones we've already really kind of discussed, and that's the flu vaccine, particularly in this season, the pneumonia vaccine for everyone, and particularly for those greater than 65. And otherwise, you know, most patients receive their immunizations as a child. And so just ensuring that you've received all of the routine health immunizations as a child, I think, is probably the best recommendation.
Thank you. And a question for Dr. Vistovsek. If I choose one treatment for myelofibrosis, does that influence any later choice that I might make? Could you address that in a general way?
Yes, of course. That's a very good question, because one would worry that there might be something with a given medication that would prevent you from receiving another one later, and that, by and large, is not true. Our approach to patients is always to offer the patients what we would suggest to be the best in a given situation, whether this medication or approach is related to counteracting big spleen and poor quality of life, or anemia, or all three together, or whether there is a role for transplant in the care of that given person with the myelofibrosis. This is usually discussed one-on-one or with the family in presence in the clinician's office, and it is our usual approach to give patients the spectrum of possibilities, but of course suggest what would be the best as you would treat your family member. And if there would be a harm later on from one approach to a next one, that obviously would need to be revealed, and that is not the case. We go from one to another if necessary, and in my experience, there is no harm from one therapy to the other therapy, if the other therapy isn't necessary.
Thank you so much. Thank you. I know that's a concern often of people, and that's really helpful, Dr. Vistovsek. Thank you for that, that excellent answer. And another question, what impact may myelofibrosis and its treatment have on my fertility or menopause? Dr. Goen, can you address that?
To my understanding, and please, Dr. Vistovsek, if you have any more information, please jump in on this, particularly the JAK inhibitors, there's no impact on fertility. Now, certainly if transplant was employed in the course of the treatment for myelofibrosis, high doses of chemotherapy certainly can affect fertility. But the mainstay of treatment are those who do not undergo transplant, things with JAK inhibitors, steroids, some of the immune modulators. Those, to my knowledge, really have no effect on fertility or even menopause. What do you think, Dr. Vistovsek? Anything to add?
I think that's a good assessment. The transplant, obviously, involving intensive chemotherapy will affect the fertility and change the hormonal balance in the patient's body, which settles later on after the procedure. But current therapies, to my knowledge, also don't interfere with that. On the other hand, we also need to add that to become a pregnant while taking any of these medications, being the JAK inhibitors or investigational agents or thalidomide or some others, it's not advisable at all. And by and large, all these therapies, unless you're talking about the prednisone, discourage and forbid, actually, administration of the medications by a practitioner if there is a contemplation of a pregnancy or the patient or lady is pregnant already. So we need to be cautious about it, and this is the other angle of the question that needs to be addressed.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. So these are issues that really and concerns in terms of talking with your healthcare team that you really want to raise and discuss. They're very important issues, so that we basically encourage that kind of discussion. Is that correct, Dr. Goen?
Then absolutely, absolutely.
So there is another question from one of our online participants about. The value of a bone marrow biopsy, and how do I cope with it? Dr. Goen, could you address that?
Well, the value of a bone marrow biopsy is in that of a diagnostic procedure. That's when we're working up reasons of why your blood counts are low or perhaps your spleen is enlarged and we're thinking about myelofibrosis. That bone marrow biopsy is really essential for making that diagnosis. Now, as far as monitoring therapy, if you've already been diagnosed with myelofibrosis and you're receiving therapy and your provider perhaps is bringing up another bone marrow biopsy, sometimes it's nice to monitor progression of the disease, and this can sometimes change our therapeutic recommendations, and that's particularly true if you're on a clinical trial. So it's hard for me to know the exact scenario of why your provider is recommending a bone marrow biopsy now, but in general, I hope that kind of outlines the different kind of scenarios of why, as providers, we are recommending bone marrow biopsies.
There is one situation where I would think there is a good reason to do a bone marrow biopsy in everyday practice, and this is if the doctor is worried about a change that we call transformation to acute leukemia.
Right.
Acute leukemia does happen in some patients with myelofibrosis, and this can be suspected from looking at the blood cell count. We mentioned earlier on that one of the diagnostic criteria for myelofibrosis is the presence of bone marrow cells in blood. This is so-called the left shift, to make it simpler, because we have early baby cells there. And in some patients, the early baby cells called blasts may increase in percentage-wise in the blood, which worries us because then that would indicate that where the cells come from, the bone marrow also has more blasts than normal. And normal for a bone marrow is to have up to 5% of blasts. So if the blasts in the blood go up, then one would like to do the bone marrow biopsy to see what's going on with the bone marrow. And certainly we don't like abnormal percent of blasts in a bone marrow, because that would indicate potential for progression to acute leukemia, which is much more aggressive and harder to treat. Otherwise, in everyday practice, there is less of a reason to do routine bone marrow biopsies for two reasons. The disease, usually it's not much changed by the therapies. We aim to improve the either red blood cell count to counteract anemia, shrink the spleen or liver, and there is no decision usually made on a repetitive bone marrow biopsies, because there might be some changes among them, but they don't really impact what we do clinically with the patient. And unless, as mentioned by Dr. Govan, there is a need as a part of clinical study that aims to alter the bone marrow, and that certainly is important test to do then.
Excellent. Very, very helpful. Thank you very much. And we have a question from one of our online participants. Can a patient go back on ruxolitinib after failure of this therapy? How often does this happen? And if so, what type of response is seen if going back on? Dr. Vistovsek, can you address that question?
So the question was about the ruxolitinib, correct?
Yes.
Okay. So ruxolitinib has been evaluated, as mentioned before, in the randomized studies. Dr. Roberts was eloquently explained how was this done and what was the purpose. So now we have patients that have been followed for a long term on these studies for several years, and we learn as we go about the durability of the therapy, what are the long consequences, are there any other toxicities, are there any other benefits, and so on. For practical purposes, we look at what evidently is there right away, the benefit on spleen and symptoms, which happen right away within few months, and they, in advanced patients like were in these studies, last on average several years, 3 years it seems, or even longer. And people can live longer for a few years with good control of signs and symptoms. There are other JAK inhibitors, however, in development that are important to mention. They are in phase 3 approval studies. These are momelotinib and pacritinib that are beneficial in a number of patients, and that's why they are being tested for possible approval in phase 3 randomized studies that can provide similar benefits or perhaps even additional benefits without decreasing the blood cell count too much, one of them, or perhaps making people transfusion independent with a different one. So there are slight differences among them. They're not all the same. And one may see in past experience in these clinical studies that patients went from one study to another study and were exposed to different JAK2 inhibitors and did respond. So there is no, to my knowledge, yet a description of an ultimate resistance mechanism that would prevent patients from perhaps benefiting again to the same or a different JAK2 inhibitors after a certain period of time of a washout, if you like, from the initial one. So it is possible to retreat the patient after a certain period of time, weeks or months, again, and there is a possibility to have a response again, perhaps to not to the same extent, but it is possible to have another response, yes.
Awesome. Thank you very much. And another question, does ruxolitinib affect the allelic burden of this disease? Dr. Goen, could you address that and also define allelic burden?
When you're looking at myelofibrosis, very often we test for the JAK2 V617F mutation. And that's a mutation that's experienced in about 50% of those afflicted with myelofibrosis. And we can actually measure how many copies of the gene is there in a given patient. And truly, in the scientific community, there's some controversy about how to interpret that data, but some therapies are found to really reduce the amount of what we call the allelic burden or copies of the gene in the bloodstream. Now, ruxolitinib, I believe, has had some evidence of reducing allelic burden, but not much. And I think that it's not typically agreed upon in the scientific community that ruxolitinib itself reduces allelic burden. And I think Dr. Verstovsek can certainly address that as well. There is some data in alternate therapies such as interferon. Now, interferon has some interesting studies about reducing allelic burden. Now, how that translates into the prognosis and into the symptoms of the patient is still controversial. Dr. Verstovsek, do you want to maybe address ruxolitinib and how it affects the allelic burden?
So I think this was a very good summary, indeed. You're right. The testing is available. One can test this allelic burden and number of copies of a gene. Sometimes I make it simple and say this is the number of cells that carry the gene, so if the number is lower, there might be a lower number of cells in your blood or bone marrow that have that gene. But we know very well that this disease is not all about the JAK2 mutation. There are many other mutations, and there might be different cell clones in a given patient, which is actually very often the case in patients with myelofibrosis that carry other mutations. It's not only about the JAK2 mutation, and the focus on that particular mutation is possibly just because it was the first one that was described and so much focus was on it. But the JAK inhibitors are not specific for the JAK2 mutation. They may a little bit decrease the number of cells with the mutation in the blood, but that doesn't have any clinical relevance for the outcome of the patients. And we do not suggest that measurement to be done because it does not impact on the management of the patient. Similar to what we discussed about the bone marrow biopsies, there is no routine need for them. There is no routine measurement of allelic burden with JAK2 mutation because of the complexity of the disease and not having a medication that would actually eliminate disease. So it should be very simple for management of the patients with JAK inhibitors. Establishing diagnosis and a need for therapy, which would be presence of a significant symptoms or symptomatic splenomegaly, intermediate or high-risk patients, and aiming to treat those problems, to counteract them, make people enjoy life fully for as long as possible, and that obviously we can achieve, but unfortunately we can't eliminate disease. So looking at CBC, adjusting the dose is all that it takes. There is no need for a allelic burden measurement or the bone marrow biopsies.
Excellent. Thank you so much. And a question for Ms. Eckhart from one of our online participants. I worry a lot about my myelofibrosis, I'm being treated successfully for it, but I am somewhat distracted and worried. Are there things I can do to help to cope with my feelings about this?
Well, sure, I'd be happy to answer that. It is why we have our Cancer Care Hopeline. It is a place for to discuss those feelings that are coming up about the diagnosis, about the treatments, just about handling it in the day-to-day. And so I would certainly encourage them to call our Hopeline and speak with one of our oncology social workers to see about you know, just what's happening now with their support systems, how their routines have changed, and just having a voice and a place, a safe space to be able to talk about the feelings and the things that are coming up for them. I do want to say that having new feelings and thoughts about the diagnosis and about their current situation and what the future is going to be like is something that I hear from almost every single person who calls. So this is a very normal thing. It's something that we are skilled at addressing, and we certainly look forward to their calls. We can talk with you to see if face-to-face support is something that would be the most meaningful, or maybe one of our online groups or something in the community. It's something that, again, that's what we're here for.
Well, thank you. That's excellent. Thank you very much. Thank you. And another question, which will be our last question, can you recommend any diet, exercise, or vitamins that would help me? Dr. Goen, do you want to address that?
Certainly. So as far as the diet, the general dietary recommendation that I make for my patients who, again, do not have neutropenia or very low white blood cells is a simple Mediterranean-based kind of diet, meaning that the proteins are primarily from white proteins such as chicken, turkey, or fish, and that there's a large, substantial portion of vegetables and fruit, particularly the vegetables and green leafy vegetables that are represented on a plate at each meal. Now, as far as exercise, the general recommendation is to try to get exercise at least 30 minutes most days of the week and at least 2 hours per week. Now, that really can be variable as far as what type of exercise, whatever makes you happy, and maybe limited as far as what your symptoms are. If you're having a lot of bone or joint pain, then perhaps swimming would be most appropriate. Certainly, if you have a very enlarged spleen, I do not recommend high-impact sports such as skiing, snowboarding, football, these kinds of things, and more kind of simple, easy-to-do kind of exercises that do not place you at risk of a splenic trauma. Now, finally, to address vitamins, I have no general supplement recommendations. I think food is really the best medicine, and if you're eating a well-balanced diet from all the food groups and getting lots of fruits and vegetables, then you don't need supplementary vitamins. And so that's my typical recommendation, is really to try to get all of your vitamins that you can from your diet.
Excellent. Well, I want to thank our speakers today. You've just been extraordinary. It's been an amazing call, and I want to also thank all of you who've been listening and all of you who've asked questions, mostly online, which is really amazing, and just the excellent, really outstanding questions. We have an outstanding audience as well today. I want to thank you all for participating today. I also realize that we are entering a holiday time of year, and that means that a lot of the information you got today is particularly important for you to incorporate into your life in terms of your lifestyle. And most importantly, I don't want anyone to feel that you're alone in coping with myelofibrosis or coping with cancer. I want you to now know that you're part of this cancer care community and that we're here to help you. And I think Ms. Eckhardt reviewed all of our services. They're all free. And we're available by calling 1-800-813-HOPE, our helpline. And we have all these oncology social workers here to address your questions. All of our services are free. And we provide practical and financial assistance. We provide counseling, a chance to talk with someone about your feelings and how you're doing or questions that you might have or resources that you might need. And we also have all these different groups that we, of course, are available to you. And we do also have these workshops. And, indeed, there is a part two to this workshop, which will occur on January 14th, coping with the stress of caregiving when your loved one has myelofibrosis. So for caregivers, but also everyone is welcome to listen to that workshop as well. So, again, I want to thank you all for your participation today, and I want to wish you all a very fine day. Thank you all.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop. You may now disconnect, and everyone have a great day.